Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to start today by taking a look at what lies amidst the rubble and weeds where factories and businesses once stood. Our guest says a great deal of natural beauty resides there, and our guest, Christopher Brown, is an Austin, Texas-based writer, lawyer, and author. He's written three novels, but his first nonfiction book is titled The Natural History of Empty Lots, Field Notes from Urban Edgelands, Back Alleys, and Other Wild Places. The book is based on an urban nature newsletter titled Field Notes, which Chris Brown has authored since 2020. And as we talk with Christopher, I hope you'll join in. Call in with your questions about the rewilding of land used and discarded by industry. You have some in your area that maybe you notice, or maybe you kind of pass by and never pay any attention to. I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about those spots. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Christopher Brown, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Larry. Great to talk to you.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed your book. It's a work of nonfiction, nature writing, really, and a memoir, I think. Before this, you wrote three novels, science fiction and some legal thrillers. Why did you want to write this very different book?
You know, well, while I was writing novels, I had spent about 20 years exploring, initially as a young dad looking for things to do with my son, and then solo, exploring these wild spaces that exist in the city, in the kind of interstices and the edges of the cities, something I really even did as a kid growing up in the Midwest, and reinvigorated after I got down here to Texas. And I found that it was, you know, really a fascinating and kind of underexplored aspect of how we live and how close we really do live to natural wonder, even in the heart of the city. And so when I finished my last novel, I started this kind of weekly newsletter that conveniently turned out to be 2 weeks before the pandemic started, when people were especially interested in this kind of material, just kind of writing like a little dispatch, you know, like Aldo Leopold style, from, you know, a little walk in the woods behind the dairy plant, or, you know, crossing the urban river or down under the overpass and reporting on the things I saw and found. And I learned that people were super interested in that. And so I wanted to write a book that kind of shared the things I learned in those explorations and in rewilding our own backyard, basically taking kind of Midwest style prairie restoration techniques and applying them in Texas. And then maybe some of the lessons about, you know, kind of wider lessons about how we might, you know, rewild our future and maybe build a little bit of a better tomorrow.
Yeah, it's really an interesting book because you managed to go back in history on many occasions and talk about what the land was like before. And the animals, I found that very interesting. And you did have a spot early on where you talked to, you gave a bit of advice in a way about how to find those areas in, you know, anybody's own place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes the easiest way to find these kinds of places is to get a little bit lost, whether accidentally or on purpose, because these kinds of places, the places where wild nature reasserts itself in the city, are usually, or often at least, spaces that aren't really designed for people, or places that people have kind of abandoned active use of. But they're surprisingly easy to find once you learn to look for them. They're, you know, any place where people have stopped paying attention and plants and animals find room to move in, empty lots, old industrial sites, rights of way, the areas around urban creeks and rivers, and, you know, the kind of liminal zones and edges between other land uses, even brownfields that in other areas that have been deemed off limits. And, you know, if you sort of think like an animal might think of where would you go if you wanted to bed down for an evening without being bothered by anybody. That's usually a pretty good guide.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're right that nature, it's more beautiful in places that are damaged and scarred by industrial abuse. Some people might say, well, how can that be? How is it possible?
I think more than anything, when you sort of stumble upon an expanse of native plants that have sort of retaken an empty field around or behind some old abandoned 20th century industrial site, an old gravel pit that was totally trashed out 20 or 30 years ago and has now been kind of fully rewilded, not through any attention from, you know, the Parks Department or the DNR, but just from nature doing its own thing. It's really affirming in the evidence it gives of nature's inherent resilience and ability to adapt to and recover from, you know, the worst we throw at it, or, you know, or other conditions in the climate might throw at it. And so, and it has a kind of a romance, it's like, you know, seeing a coyote crossing the train tracks at the edge of downtown, or, you know, seeing a beautiful raptor, you know, sort of hunting along the tollway at the edge of town. There's a beauty to that and a reminder that, you know, even in the heart of urbanity, where we think we're sort of, you know, trapped in the middle of the human machine, we're actually very connected with nature. And in many cases, you find that, you know, a lot of species of wildlife are making home in the city because it's the only place they have left.
Yeah, I see. But maybe it'd be kind of cool. You do such a nice job of describing some of the areas in Austin. Can you describe some of those areas for us and what you see when you go into them?
Yeah, so a lot of the book is centered on the area where I live, which is just east of downtown Austin, in a zone that's we live on a little like urban acre that's right in the liminal space between a very heavily developed old industrial corridor that's now sort of, you know, slowly transitioning into newer, more kind of new urbanist kinds of uses. And then behind that, a pocket of urban woods along the lower Colorado River, where just a mile or so from us upriver, maybe half a mile, there's the last dam that holds in that river for flood control between here and the Gulf of Mexico, 300 miles downriver. So it's much more like the natural channel of the river. And when you approached it from the street, you might think you were in the weirdest, creepiest, scariest industrial neighborhood you've ever seen. There's like, I've got an abandoned lighting factory and an old 1940s furniture factory, both of which are like covered in graffiti. And there's a kind of a, you know, rundown little, door factory, and then a big old milk plant that has just gone obsolete, and half of those things are like covered in graffiti, and they look like, you know, the set of an apocalypse zombie video game or something. But you go back behind there through the fences, and there's pockets of public land in there. You don't have to trespass to access it, and you know, when you're on the floodplain of a navigable waterway, that's all basically, you know, the commons under the U.S. Constitution. And so you go down in there and you find these swaths of woods that have taken over what 20 or 30 years ago was heavily used for mineral extraction, to drag out river rock, to make aggregate, to make roads, and to make, you know, foundations for tall buildings and whatnot. And in the, you know, and it's tall cottonwoods that, you know, grow the tallest where the big drainage pipes are emptying out. And, you know, and it's just vital habitat for coyotes, foxes, all manner of waterfowl, you know, egrets and herons and venomous snakes. As in Texas, not the Midwest, it's one of the notable differences, right? And you know, raptors, everything from the occasional bald eagle in the winter down here, not in the summer so much, and osprey, you know, the kind of river hawks are down here all winter long, and then all kinds of strange, like, tree-burrowing ducks that come around in the summer, and, you know, kingfisher and whatnot. And so you'll be down in there and you'll, you know, you can still hear some of the sounds of the factories that are active, and you can hear the, you know, trucks rolling down and downshifting on the nearby old bridge, and you can hear the planes coming in to land, and you can also hear the cry of the osprey or the red-shouldered hawk or the quack of the ducks, and maybe when the police sirens start screaming down the boulevard, you'll hear at night, you'll hear the coyotes out in the woods calling back to the sirens as if it's their lost cousin or something. And it's just, it's a kind of a weird, mixed up, you know, Anthropocene reality that we occupy, and I find it to be pretty fun.
It sounds like a lot of fun. I remember you writing about a pepper. This is kind of what it was so interesting about your book. You'll often zero in on a plant or an animal and give us a little history. There was a chilipetin pepper?
Yeah, chiltepinian, or it's often called chilipekin. They're sort of two similar plants that get kind of an interchangeable name. There's this funny little hot pepper that I didn't even know about until I'd been down here for a while, and there was this visiting landscaper, a guy from Indiana who had kind of learned the plant center. He's like, oh, you know what that is? And it turned out it was, yeah, this chilipekin or chiltepin, which is a wild hot pepper that can only germinate after it's been digested by a bird and, you know, and dropped out at the other end of the bird. And it's tiny. It's about the size of like a big teardrop. And it's green until it ripens, and then it turns the red, that kind of red of a jalapeno pepper. And it's really interesting because it's this plant that can only grow wild. So you really only find it in these kinds of empty lot kinds of places, often, you know, under trees or along fence rows, as you might imagine, once you learn how they germinate. And a little research, and I learned that this pepper, that the name comes from the language of the Aztecs, Nahuatl, when it means like flea pepper or meant it to them. And it's the original pepper from which all the other peppers of the North American table have been derived somehow through, you know, human manipulation, even though, you know, through grafting, since you couldn't, you know, you can't grow the plant from a seed. And when you see something, just kind of some scrubby little plant in your yard that might otherwise be unremarkable, and you see the connection it gives you to the deep past of the land, to a past that really even precedes like human habitation of the continent, and a thing that can only grow wild. It's a beautiful discovery, and then you find out how good it tastes, and that you can, you know, make a hot vinegar, you know, that you can put over any meal on your dinner table, and it's kind of like extra credit, and it's the fun of, you know, foraging your own kind of rundown part of town and finding there's all kinds of amazing food to be found.
I thought it was really cool, and the fact that it, I mean, all of our peppers, our bell peppers, our serranos, every pepper we enjoy came from that pepper. I mean, yeah. It makes you look at that plant a whole lot differently. I mean, with some awe.
Yeah, with some absolute awe. That's right. And it helps you think about our connection to the natural world and how much of our reality comes from the ways in which we have figured out how to control the reproduction of other life and, you know, make it serve us. And the way it helps you think about and appreciate the power of those natural wild plants and how connected they are with our original roots as, you know, foragers and hunters.
Yeah. Christopher Brown, our guest today, his book, his new book out, A Natural History, Field Notes, I should say, A Natural History of Empty Lots, Field Notes from Urban Edgelands, Back Alleys, and Other Wild Places. And we're going to give you a chance to join in about now. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. We'll get to Merrill and Madison in just a minute. But first, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. talking with Christopher Brown. He authored the book A Natural History of Empty Lots, and I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts about empty lots and what it might mean to you. Do you ignore them? Do you spend some time in them? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Mrill in Madison. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Larry. I love this topic. And Christopher, thank you for writing the book. I think following my dog, I ended up crashing around in a lot of spaces like these. And I found this topic's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And I just really appreciate how you're sort of peeling back the layers and realizing there's every one of these places is different and has a story to tell about our history and our relationship with different plants. And I just wanted to follow up with a couple of things for me, because I have thought about this topic a lot. But one is that I think they're kind of like a call to action, because they are sort of ignored spaces. And a lot of the ways we maintain our infrastructure is we purposely exclude with things like fencing and asphalt and pesticides, herbicides. And so the more that we can work with cities and other developers to really think about how to get involved and to encourage more species diversity and to tell the stories of those places. Like just around my own neighborhood, the history of Indian mounds is incredible. And they're really kind of hidden and many are obliterated. But with a little bit of investigation, you can learn so much. So I think there's a really great opportunity. And also a lot of these spaces, the way they're distributed, you know, there can be some ones that are not at all easy to romanticize about, and they tend to be clustered in areas where there are people who have less money, real estate values are lower and stuff like that. So I have really just thought a lot about these spaces. I actually wrote a book a couple years ago called Loving Orphan Space. So I just wanted to download all that because I love this topic. I think it's like an environmental frontier for us.
Morel, thank you so much. Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I completely agree. I think one of the things you find when you start exploring these spaces and seeing how much life they often harbor, how much urban biodiversity there really is in the kind of negative space of the city, you start to connect with this other life around, and then you soon realize how threatened it is by development. Like where we live, it is a historically industrial neighborhood. It's also in the fastest growing city in America, or what it has been for most of the last 15 years. And, you know, development attention is on the neighborhood, and these kinds of ignored spaces are not going to be ignored for long. And, you know, when we live on a planet where, if you can believe the World Wildlife Fund, something like, according to their most recent report, 73% of the vertebrate wildlife population of the planet has disappeared since 1970. And even if that number is wrong, maybe it's half that number, it's an extreme statistic. So thinking about urban biodiversity and how we create more space within the city to, you know, share our habitat with the other life that we share the earth with, I think it's an important undertaking. And I completely agree with your sentiment. And with the history that's around us as well, the indigenous history that's manifest in the land.
Yeah. Morel, thank you so much for calling. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. I was thinking about the city of Madison, where I am currently broadcasting the show from. And we had an area, the Garver Feed Mill was an old feed mill that was right next to the place called Starkweather Creek. And I would kayak up that Starkweather Creek, and it was as though there were places along, and of course that feed mill had been abandoned for many, 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 many years, but you could kayak up that creek, and it was like you were not in the city anymore. You could still hear a little bit from time to time, but the difference in the wildlife and the plant life in some areas just behind the Garver Mill were really, really different from the rest of the city. Let's put it that way. And finally, the Garver feed mill was, someone bought it and restored it into a very active place with many businesses of kind of, it's now a very beautiful building. But then at the same time, some parts of that back area are gone. And, you know, I like the Garver feed mill. I like to go over there. There's a pizza place and there's a lot of places where you can have fun and enjoy the mill. But at the same time, if you're kayaking up the Starkweather Creek, you're seeing something a little different.
Yeah, I mean, having there are places like that, I think, in every city. I mean, like, I grew up in Des Moines, and it was like that up along the Raccoon River where there wasn't a lot of flood control. And yet there were lots of industrial uses, but they just couldn't keep out the wild activity. And that's the same kind of thing here. And people you can do that in Houston. You can even go paddle the Gowanus Canal in New York if you don't mind the toxins in the water. And it's astonishing how many places there are like this in every city. And to your point, if you know, usually they're created through inattention, right? Almost by accident. They're kind of like involuntary parks created through, obsolescence of an old industrial activity. And there are ways they can be preserved while redeveloping, you know, a zone in a way that maintains some of that wild character. And I think it's important to get people more excited about that, because when people can experience wild nature without having to, go very far from their own home, I think it really changes how they think about their relationship with the natural world and just enriches life.
Yeah.
Period.
Let's go to John in Spooner. John, hello. Thank you for calling.
You bet. Hey, what a great show, as always, Larry. But like I was telling you, your interviewer there before, I'm fortunate enough to make it to 75 years old. I grew up on the north side of Milwaukee. And my little brother and I used to spend a lot of time creeping around in old abandoned factories, and lots where factories had been torn down, and building rafts out of barrels and whatnot, floating around in ponds on, pretending we were Huckleberry Finn and whatnot. But your subject is brought back to the flood of childhood memories that were just wonderful.
Oh, John, thank you for calling. Comment on that, Christopher?
That's where I learned it as a kid. You know, I think it's been amazing to me with this book and the sort of invitation it gives to find out. Half the people you talk to are like, oh, yeah, man, I spent my whole childhood, you know, exploring places like that. Because I think we all, as children, we sort of have a natural attraction to and wonder of wild nature, and we just instinctively seek it out. We know that kind of real life, as it were, isn't to be found at the mall, you know, or on a downtown sidewalk, but in these little spaces where nature is allowed to express itself to some degree in the city. And rediscovering that as an adult is really like a secret password to kind of opening up whole other aspects of life. So I think whether you're 25 or 75, getting out there and rediscovering, you know, shortcuts into empty lots like you might have done when you're a kid, you might find it's a pretty fun thing, whether you have a kayak or just 2 feet.
Jim emailed to say Chernobyl, and you write about this briefly in the book, Chernobyl is a good example of nature's reclamation. The Babushkas of Chernobyl is an interesting documentary that follows a group of elderly women who went back to live in Chernobyl's prohibited zone, and worth checking out. But that's what you would call an involuntary park.
Right, an involuntary park. It's a term that was coined by my friend, the science fiction writer Bruce Sterling, to describe these kinds of places where the rewilding happens because they're so damaged by human activity that literally there can be no human occupation. And so the most typical kind of American example is, you know, a brownfield, a place where there's, you know, enough toxic contamination that it's not really fit for active human use, you know, your prototypical Superfund site. But also, yeah, places like the Chernobyl exclusion zone where radioactive contamination has kept people out to a large extent for a long time. And there, the rewilding has been really kind of remarkable and extreme. And you can go, yeah, that documentary I haven't seen, but there are a number of sources where you can find windows into that and lots of other folks who have written about some of those kinds of sites.
Yeah, I remember a Sports Illustrated article on the wildlife of Chernobyl and how it came back, and absolutely amazing, and how the land, the plants and everything else is just sort of reclaiming that area, just like it has happened in our own country.
Yeah.
Yeah. Victoria in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, just a couple of things. My first thing was, I know that the speaker had mentioned, like, you know, the Wildlife Federation and their documentation on species loss and how he said it might be less. I disagree. I feel like it might be more than being documented because, you know, humans have definitely done a number on the planet. So I just kind of wanted to put that out there for people to kind of mull over. And then the other thing was, how people in the community, especially these lower income communities that aren't as fortunate, can get involved in protecting these wild places. Because, you know, a lot of the times, as someone who I work in natural resources, I'm, you know, pursuing a degree in sustainable agriculture. A lot of these disturbed areas get taken over by invasive species, mostly like plants and stuff. So how do we get involved as a community in making sure that, like, native plants are being put in, or we're saving these spaces for, you know, the wildlife that is left. So I just was wondering if he had any comment about how community can get involved in this.
Yeah, I mean, on both, I'll speak to both of those questions. I mean, I completely agree with you, Victoria, about the biodiversity laws. But I'm not a natural scientist. I'm a writer and a lawyer, so I don't feel qualified to definitively opine. And I think the Living Planet report from the World Wildlife Foundation just came out a month ago, and that's the one with the 73% global number. There are, you know, debates over how you go about measuring that, but I think we can all agree that the biodiversity loss in our lifetimes is profound and like a major wake-up call we all need to give attention to, and that's a big part of what I'm trying to talk about in the book. With respect to your great point about how often these kinds of wild urban spaces that are, you know, unintentionally wild or, you know, kind of wild without the active attention of, you know, municipal or state authorities trying to steward them. It's so true, and it's very much the case in my neighborhood that there are ways in which communities and whether it's just a group of neighbors or, you know, more organized community groups can go about trying to protect these kinds of spaces from the worst industrial abuses, trying to help conserve them and set aside and protect, you know, pockets of these from development, and try to go about the active work of restoration. I do a lot of work along those lines here, working with, you know, my neighbors here in, you know, what's a historically a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood of Austin, and a lot of working class folks, a lot of families of recent immigrants, a lot of people who self-identify as indigenous. And I wouldn't be able to live on this old brownfield lot I live on if there hadn't been a group of folks who organized to shut down a big above-ground petroleum tank farm in the 90s that was, you know, leaking benzene into the soil and harming its neighbors. And we have groups like Ecology Action, an old recycling nonprofit that I'm on the board of here, and we've pivoted to now operating the restoration of a 10-acre brownfield in urban East Austin, where there was a municipal landfill. There's so much methane in the soil that they won't let us do controlled burns because it's not safe. But we've turned it back into this gorgeous, you know, urban prairie. And there's just examples of things like that all over the country. And, you know, lots of people just doing their own backyard rewilding projects and taking some of the lessons that we have, you know, especially in the Midwest, where there's really the pioneers of like prairie restoration. And you can take those lessons and apply them on, you know, much smaller pockets of land and achieve kind of, you know, islands of biodiversity within the city that connect to each other on their own. And the outcomes can be magnificent.
Yeah. Victoria, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to turn to your home, your house and property for a minute or two or more. Can you talk about the, you know, sort of the background, how you landed where you are? And then I'd love to have you talk about the building of your house and how you tried to work nature into your home.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, in the late 2000s, and in my I was in my early 40s, and I found myself as a middle-aged bachelor, a half-time single dad, renting an apartment downtown, and I had been spending all this time exploring these kinds of spaces, and I was like, well, here I am. Maybe there's a way to live in one, and also, you know, lower my overhead and try to, you know, kind of reinvent domestic life a little bit. And so I started looking around and I found this funny little urban acre that was a quasi brownfield. It had an old petroleum pipeline from this tank farm I was just describing to Victoria, diagonally bisecting it with a big valve box right in the middle, like a steel box with a kind of wheel in it, like you'd find on the hatch of a ship, as if you could open up some secret portal into the earth. And then it was just covered in all kinds of trash, you know, a lot of like construction and demolition debris, big chunks of concrete and rebar, even entire like curb cuts and whatnot. And yet it was also wild, and it was next to these urban woods, and it was, you know, it had access to the river. And so I was like, well, this is a crazy project, kind of, you know, might be kind of challenging, but it was just sort of intrinsically compelling. And so I worked with the oil company that had built that pipeline to take the pipeline out, and which was easier than you might think. And then I worked with some architects to come up with a design for a house that tried to really, like, make it more about landscape than about house, and basically bury a little house that wasn't any bigger than my apartment down in the ditch where this pipeline had been, with a green roof, and that kind of opened up to the woods, hidden from the street, and set up so that to go from room to room, you have to step outside. It's just like three rooms around a courtyard, you know, which may sound a little crazy if you're in Wisconsin in November, but this is Texas where, you know, we didn't really ever get super cold. And even then, you know, there's kind of a rigor to, you know, stepping outside even on a winter day to go get a cup of coffee in the morning or whatever. And doing green roofs in Texas is challenging. It's much easier to do up north. In Texas, we have such a harsh summer that it's really hard for the plants to endure. But the secret is you just put the native drought-resistant plants of the prairie on your roof. So we did just that, working with friends from the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center down here in Austin. And, you know, managed to have a successional blackland prairie growing on our roof, and the result is like really like a rewilded house where we just have every manner of critter walking up, you know, in the crepuscular hours to see what's up, from the raptors to the urban canids to the snakes who come in to hunt the lizards that live in the roof. So.
It is amazing, and you describe there was a funny story. You do learn then about the creatures that are around your home when you do something like this. And you talked about harvester ants. and learning about them, and yeah, kind of an amusing in a way story about the oil line.
I described how, you know, there was that big valve box for the pipeline that, and so this like steel box, and right next to that steel box is this giant denuded area made by a colony of harvester ants, which are these really big ants. Their heads are like the size of lentils, very Texas kind of creature. And they are trail builders. They like to collect seeds, and they build these little like trails through the wild grasses to send out their foragers and bring them back. You don't want to mess with them because they've got one of the most venomous bites of any insect in North America, as I have found on a couple of occasions. But what's really remarkable about them is I learned after, you know, I'd seen this pipeline removal crew try to, you know, deal with them as a biohazard and then give up and then just bury them in dirt, learning that there were probably 150,000 inhabitants in this colony that went 16 feet into the earth. Seeing the home building crew struggling with them as well, and somehow these ants survive. And then I learned that they regulate the comings and goings of their forager ants with a method that is algorithmically identical to TCP/IP, the packet switching protocol used to regulate the movement of data over the internet, where like the number of ants that are sent out by the colony are dispatched based on the speed with which ants are coming back with food. And one of those astonishing ways in which you learn that, you know, we mimic nature and or these patterns we think we have invented are all over nature. And hilariously, yeah, like we had put our, you know, internet router right in a little utility closet right next to where the mound was. So they're amazing creatures.
They are indeed. Karen in Madison, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling, Karen.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the Garver feed mill. That's my backyard now. I remember when red dot potato chip blew up, it was fire. But before that, last year I went down there in a kayak down Starkweather Creek and found muskrats and a couple animals were still, they're still living down there. There just aren't so many frogs and things around here anymore, I noticed.
Yeah. Karen, thank you very much for calling. So back to my comment earlier of the Garber feed mill and her comment about the fact there's still wildlife there, but changes as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, everything's constantly changing. I mean, you know, up there where y'all live, you can go read the works of folks like Frances Hammerstrom, the amazing naturalist who was the only female protege of Aldo Leopold and kind of one of the, like, you know, protectors of the prairie chicken. But she writes extensively about all the wild food she learned how to harvest from the urban and suburban landscape of Wisconsin. She even has a book called The Wild Food Cookbook that's a terrific and rich depiction of, you know, that, and even like recipes you can try if you want to see what the muskrat might taste like if you're so inclined. But, and I think, you know, you talk about feed mills, I think they're really interesting places. They're like really ubiquitous in the Midwestern landscape. And as I try to articulate in the book, they're also a kind of, you know, testament to, you know, they're really the foundation, the lodestones, the foundation stones of civilization in a way, because when you kind of think about how our entire civilization is really founded on this ability to control the reproduction of other life, in particular, the discovery in the Fertile Crescent of the Neolithic era of the ability to control the reproduction of grain plants, to be able to accumulate stores of grain that we can keep for, you know, the seasons when we need it. And the way that evolved into wealth and the way that provided, you know, really the foundation of civilization and all of the great things about it, but also, you know, a lot of the challenging things about it, like, you know, the things we do to control each other, to work the fields, or the, you know, the way wealth gets unequally distributed and whatnot. And so it's kind of cool seeing rewilded landscapes around feed mills and, you know, grain silos and things like that, because I think it's a sort of conceptually powerful thing to kind of witness, even without having to actively think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Christopher Brown, our guest, the book, A Natural History of Empty Lots. As we talk with him, you can join in, too. We had some great comments so far. What about you? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking with Christopher Brown about the book that he's written. It's titled A Natural History of Empty Lots. Fascinating book. And again, comments or experience to share, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Chris, you just mentioned or made comment to growing up in the Midwest, and you describe in your book growing up in the Midwest around the grain silos and the farm building and the endless fields, everything green, everything alive, but somehow lifeless. What'd you mean by that?
I mean, there's a way in which, you know, growing up in the, I grew up in Iowa, the gateway to Wisconsin, and it was, you know, you're taught that if you want to see wildlife, you get out of the city and you go out to the country, and then you go out there. And I think it's especially true in a place like Iowa, which is so completely focused on production agriculture in most of the counties. And, you know, and all you find are, you know, rows and rows of crops, which, you know, when I was a kid, they were mostly just making grain for feed and maybe some for folks. Now a lot of it is going to make fuel for machines. And wildlife is largely confined to the, you know, kind of the fence rows. And, you know, and even I remember, you know, there were pictures my dad had of, you know, going pheasant hunting in the places we lived as a kid, and there were a lot more pheasant when he was a kid than I ever saw, and you'd only rarely see one, you know, kind of like down in the ditch along the road. And so I found, even as a kid, that, like, I saw more wildlife or got more a sense of the wild in urban forests and along urban rivers and in little prairie remnants at the edge of town where, you know, the city hadn't fully overtaken it yet, and there wasn't any active agricultural use. And so, you know, seeing how, you know, how much we've changed the landscape outside of the city, and seeing how, you know, the ways in which there as well, you can start to find ways to rewild it. There's a lot going on with these kinds of prairies that people are doing, you know, partly subsidized by the ag department. But yeah, I just found, you know, all through my life that counterintuitively, you know, we think the wilderness is out there, but really, especially in the agricultural Midwestern landscape, it's in the edges of the cities.
Yeah. And in the rural areas, the farm areas, it used to be along the fence rows, which have been, with larger farms, have kind of been eliminated in many, many areas.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you go into, like, the northern parts of Iowa now, and where I still have good friends, and it's kind of like they, like, took out all the fence rows, and they have, you know, it's like, I almost think it's like these, like, giant robots just kind of, you know, it's where this glacial landscape that's so, like, tabletop flat, it's just like, yeah, there's just not a lot of room for anything but making money, right, off the land. And having spaces for other life to make room is really important to kind of be in balance.
Steve in Rockton, Illinois, up next. Steve, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, as I'm listening to Christopher and the previous caller, I believe her name was Victoria from up north, I'm reminded of these spaces being open to cultivation. And I thought of the idea of guerrilla gardening and potentially, you know, folks that discover these areas that are open and unused to establishing food forests and getting into permaculture, things like, hazelnuts possibly, or raspberries, things that would provide these folks that enjoy these areas a food source in a sort of set-it-and-forget-it wildlife reclamation. I think it would dovetail quite nicely. And as to the, I believe it was Victoria, she asked how to get involved. If someone's got a green thumb and gets into air layering for something like hazelnuts.
Hey, there you go. Well, Christopher, comment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, driving this morning, I right before I got on to join you, I saw a guy out foraging for pecans on an empty lot. It's like a place where there used to be a truck spring shop until about 6 months ago, and they tore it down to make room for who knows what's coming. But there's like three tall pecans here in an area that once was like a pecan forest, basically, you know, 200 years ago. And, you know, very Thanksgiving-themed activity, this guy with a plastic bag foraging pecans. And that idea of urban foraging and guerrilla gardening, there's a lot of power to that, and there's a lot of people doing it. I mean, I have a buddy, a writer, who has rewilded a little tiny patch of urban dirt under the elevated M train in Queens, New York, where he's planted these native wildflowers of, you know, of that region of New York, and probably not with, you know, permission from the borough authorities. And it's really gorgeous. And yeah, people can absolutely grow wild native foods that are also vibrant food sources. They can get into the work of trying to manage the invasives that tend to crowd out the native plants and get involved with groups that are doing more like coordinated prairie restoration and urban native landscape restoration. And it's a really rewarding work.
Yeah, it is. And Steve, thank you for that call. Eleanor and Madison, we can maybe wind up kind of with you. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I also live in Madison, and, you know, the Oscar Mayer plant, it's a 1.5 million square foot, largely empty building, 70 acres, 3 miles from city center with 30 plus developable acres. It's on a bike path, it's on a highway, it's on a railroad. And it seems to me like such a wasted opportunity for issues like this. So my question is, how do we balance the responsibility of developers and local governments to sort of step in and sort of have a say in this rewilding effort?
It's such a great question, and it's something I've worked on a lot down here. And we have found, you know, that most developers approached right are interested in figuring out ways to have some measure of, you know, wild landscape restoration. We've worked with a lot of riverfront developers in zones where there are zoning rules that help us get some leverage with them. But we've even worked with folks like the Tesla factory. Elon Musk built this, you know, Tesla built this huge gigafactory just downriver from us. And we were able to work with them to at least work to restore the riparian corridor of what had been an old gravel pit where they built their factory. And in the United Kingdom, the conservative government there earlier this year before the elections, they put in place new rules that require nationwide for any new real estate development bigger than one single family home, the developer has to demonstrate after the completion of the project a 10% net gain in biodiversity. And, you know, my reaction is if they can do it there, surely we can do it here, where the erasure of the native landscape is so much more recent as anybody who, you know, has grown up in the Midwest or in Texas knows. I mean, you leave a little urban ditch alone and suddenly these, you know, native flowers will start appearing or native grasses will start appearing. And I think there are ways we can do it. We just need to make it a priority. And that starts with people waking up to the bounty of wild habitat that exists inside the cities.
And on that note, I want to thank you so much, Christopher, for being with us today. I really enjoyed your book, and obviously a lot of interest in it. And I hope we get a chance to visit again. Thank you so much.
I would love that, Larry. Thank you so much, and thanks to your listeners.
Christopher Brown's book is titled A Natural History of Empty Lots. Really fascinating read, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. Coming up, we're going to talk about converting single-use plastics into renewable energy and other things. I'm Larry Mueller.